Well, right now, US senators are grilling senior defense officials about the withdrawal of military forces from Afghanistan and the collapse of the Afghan government. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley, and the head of Central Command, General Kenneth McKenzie, are all testifying. The Biden administration has been widely accused of being unprepared for the fall of Kabul. Senior officials have admitted that Taliban forces advanced far more quickly than anticipated.
We helped build a state, Mr. Chairman, but we could not forge a nation. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise, and it would be dishonest to claim otherwise. We need to consider some uncomfortable truths. That we didn't fully comprehend the depth of corruption and poor leadership in the senior ranks. That we didn't grasp the damaging effect of frequent and unexplained rotations by President Ghani of his commanders. That we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement. And that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers.
Well, those proceedings are continuing right now on Capitol Hill. Let's listen in.
But to the families of those who have been deployed over and over again into Iraq and Afghanistan over the course of the last 20 years, they are relieved that America is now turning the page and rejecting the notion that we should be a nation in permanent war. Second, the effort to evacuate more than 120,000 people to safety under chaotic circumstances was remarkable. I visited the Dulles Expo Center, the principal arrival point for about 80% of the Afghans. I also visited Fort Lee, the first of the 8 forts that process Afghans. And I visited with Afghans, our troops, the many federal agencies working together, NGOs. The competent and compassionate service on the American side and the deep gratitude among Afghans made a deep impression on me. We should do all we can to make that transition to safe life in America as productive as possible. My chief criticism and question is this: why did the Afghan security force and civilian government collapse so quickly, and why did the U.S. so overestimate their capacity? The second half of the question, why we overestimated their capacity, is very important. To any who have said we couldn't see this coming, the members of this committee know that's wrong. An immediate collapse may not have been the most likely outcome, but we have heard for years, particularly from the intel community, that DOD estimates of Afghan strength were way too optimistic. I believe the U.S. government had a good evacuation plan, but it was premised on an Afghan civilian and military government that showed high resistance to the Taliban. And so we did not adequately plan for the real possibility of a quick collapse. We need to explore both military and interagency decision-making processes to understand why we were unrealistic and how to correct that going forward. But the most important part of the question is why a military we had trained for 20 years at a cost of $800+ billion collapsed so quickly. I can think of 3 reasons, but after I put them on the table, I would like each of you, beginning with General McKenzie, to address the question, and if we can't, we can do it when we come back after lunch. First, the lightning collapse may show that our training was insufficient and that it did not prepare the Afghan military to defend the country on their own. That should have been our goal, but we failed to accomplish it. If so, how must we change our thinking about training foreign militaries? Second, the lightning collapse may not prove that the ANSF were poor fighters, but that they were demoralized. Did they lack confidence in their own political and military leaders? Were they demoralized by a 2020 peace agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban that didn't even include the Afghan government? Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce the peace agreement for the record.
Without objection.
Did U.S. and allied funding deepen a culture of corruption that long predated our involvement? Even the best fighting force may give in if they have no confidence in their leadership. Third, the lightning collapse may show that we wanted things for Afghans that Afghan leadership did not want for themselves. We celebrated gains in public health and women's education, and we assumed that Afghans would fight to preserve those gains rather than allow the Taliban to take over. In other words, we thought we knew what Afghans wanted, what they feared, and what they would fight for. But was our belief, though well-intentioned, incredibly naive? We can't get 1/3 of Americans to take a COVID vaccine or accept the results of a presidential election. Do we really think we can transform the culture of another nation? So to each of our witnesses, when we return in the second round, I will ask you this question. Why do you believe the Afghan military and civilian government collapsed so quickly? With that, I'll yield back to the chair.
Well, let's bring in our correspondent, Patty Culhane. She's watching proceedings for us in Washington, D.C. Patty, some very tough questions there to answer today, including some, as we've been hearing, pointed ones about intelligence failures and, I imagine, also about civilian casualties.
They did bring up that drone strike, which, when it first happened, General Mark Milley said was a righteous strike. It turned out that it was an aid worker, and 10 Afghans died, including 7 children. On intelligence, I thought this was somewhat newsworthy. General Milley said that the intelligence was a complete failure, and he pointed to perhaps why. He said, look, we can point to how many guns and how many planes and how many helicopters and Humvees we've given them, but we don't know what the hearts of the soldiers are unless we have advisors on the ground with them. And he said, we stopped putting advisors with them for 3 years. So another thing he said is one of the lessons they're learning is perhaps they try to make the Afghan military too much like the American military, trying to give them high-tech equipment when perhaps that's not what was needed. As for exactly how the Pentagon, though, didn't see this coming, the Pentagon likes to say they have a plan for everything. We just heard the Secretary of Defense admit that they never tabletop exercises, to, well, how they plan tabletop exercises, that they never had one where it showed the complete collapse of the Taliban. So lots of pointed questions being asked, but the big one they want to know is how many Americans are still in Afghanistan. They're trying to point the finger at state. We just heard from a U.S. senator said, no, I'm going to need those numbers by the end of this hearing. So a lot of pointed questions so far, a lot of blame game going on. We see people saying that Donald Trump made the deal with the Taliban, and so it was doomed mission from that point on. And then Republicans are saying, look, what Joe Biden was responsible for, the drawdown that was just so chaotic and some say embarrassing.
Patty Culhane there watching those proceedings for us on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much, Patty. Well, meanwhile, in Afghanistan, the Taliban says it's planning to implement a constitution from nearly 6 decades ago now. Afghanistan's new rulers want to apply it only where it doesn't conflict with their version of Islamic law. The existing constitution was drawn up with the help of the US back in 2004, but the Taliban says it wants no foreign interference. Hashim Al-Bara has more now from Kabul.
The Taliban seem to be trying to extend an olive branch to the international community by saying, look, we could have resurrected the constitutional declaration of 1998 when the Taliban were in power here in Afghanistan. Instead, we chose to go for the 1964 constitution. Why that constitution in particular? Because it's widely seen as the constitution that paved the way for constitutional democracy, protected the right of expression, the right, the freedom of expression and the freedom of thought, established independent institutions with an independent judiciary. However, there's a caveat to that constitution. 1964 states that the king has the right to dissolve the parliament and appoint the prime minister. Under the current situation, it seems that the supreme leader of the Taliban, the Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Haybatullah Akhundzada, will ultimately have the final say. He could be the one to fire the government and appoint a new parliament, dissolve the parliament, sorry, or decide that this provision is in conflict with the Sharia law and therefore it has to be changed.
Well, let's now speak to Jennifer Mutavashvili. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, focusing on Central Asia and Afghanistan. She joins us now from Pittsburgh. Jennifer, this is a constitution that grants women the right to vote, but given that the Taliban says they'll eliminate any elements that they disagree with, what do you think it's actually going to look like?
I don't think that they're implementing this constitution to give women the rights to vote. And they've been very clear that they don't think that democracy is the way forward. They're implementing this constitution to get political recognition, simply to establish a political order. But without a constitution, it would be very hard for them to have a government. So this constitution becomes very important for them instrumentally to get that kind of international recognition. And that they've said that they'll be able to cherry pick the parts of the constitution that they believe contradict their rule. And they've been pretty clear about democracy as not being symbolic of where they think the country needs to go.
Well, there have been a lot of promises that Taliban rule this time round would take a more inclusive form, but there are obviously still no women in the caretaker government. Does this move, as you suggest, get them more of the legitimacy that they crave in the eyes of the world, or does that potentially backfire?
I think it gives them a framework for governance. It creates, you know, as the correspondent just said, as the story from Kabul said, it gives the head of the Taliban the right, sort of the power of a king, and he can then allow the government to create laws and dismiss laws as he sees fit. So it really gives authoritarian power. This, you know, did create a constitutional monarchy. It wasn't a democracy. So, you know, I don't think it does much in terms of changing much on the ground, but it does give a framework for laws. And I think this is just an incremental step that they're trying to use to get this recognition.
Sure. If they are cherry-picking parts of the Constitution, then who right now decides what to keep and what to get rid of?
It's the senior leadership. And they're using this as a bargaining chip with the international community. Mm. So they're using gender rights, they're using inclusivity as something that they can bargain with the international community in order to get aid. This is a very dangerous game that they're playing because on the one hand, they're selecting this constitution, not the 2004 constitution. They're going back to this constitution because they say that the 2004 constitution was created by the puppets, the puppet government. It was created by the international, by the United States and foreigners. So the 1964 constitution in their eyes is more pure. The danger with using women's rights and inclusivity as bargaining chips to get international aid is the Taliban are then going to fall prey to the same trap that they accused the Ghani government of. They're positioning themselves before international donors and changing their position based on what aid that they can receive. This creates a huge opening for groups like ISIS and others who will then accuse the Taliban of becoming puppets to the foreigners because they're using this to get leverage for aid.
Well, Jennifer, there is a commission that was meant to be formed next year, I believe, to draft a new constitution. How does that all fit into this process? Could we potentially see that entire constitutional process abandoned after this happens?
No, this is actually an old play. In fact, the United States adopted this 1964 constitution in 2001, right after the Taliban government collapsed, the previous Taliban government. And so for 3 years, the 1964 constitution was used as the constitutional framework in Afghanistan before the 2004 constitution was established. And what that does is it allows the framework of government to continue. It allows the center to continue appointment. Ministers continue to appoint provincial governors and district governors the same way that the 1964 constitution did. In fact, the 2004 constitution was hardly a departure from this 1964 constitution. There were many things that these two constitutions had. They were quite similar to one another, and they were both very authoritarian in nature. So this is not a good sign going into the next few months.
Very interesting indeed. Jennifer Mutavashvili there, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Centre. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us on Al Jazeera. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you.